Shepherd.
May it please the court, Katie Shepherd for Mr. Senegal. In its 2022 opinion, this court correctly held that the district court more likely than not relied on the residual clause when sentencing Mr. Senegal under the Armed Career Criminal Act. The district court sentenced him in 2008, and in 2007, this court had held in Davis that a conviction for Texas robbery qualified as an ACCA predicate under the residual clause. So in light of the legal landscape at the time of sentencing, the district court more likely than not relied on the residual clause. Now, however, under Floyd and Rose and Johnson, Mr. Senegal's ACCA sentences are unconstitutional, and the district court's reliance on the residual clause was not harmless. The court should apply the sentencing package doctrine and remand for resentencing. The sentencing package doctrine applies when the court's decision alters a portion of the district court's...
Before we get to the sentencing package, because there are three or four fun little issues here, obviously of great significance for your client, the two obstacles the government brings up that I'd love to explore a little bit, one is procedural default, and the other is concurrent sentence doctrine. So sort of antecedent to us getting to the package doctrine.
So as far as procedural default, this court also correctly held in 2022 that it should not address that because the government had not raised it in the district court.
Okay, so
the government has
on that. Well, but and I make this mistake often myself. When you say waive, it's more forfeiture, right? They have, as of February of what, 2020, they did assert it.
2022.
Yeah.
So in this case, I don't think it's just forfeiture. I think it is waiver, in part because when Mr. Senegal originally filed his Johnson-based 2255 in his then district of incarceration in Florida, the government responded in that case and did mention procedural default in its filing. And then Mr. Senegal realized his mistake and refiled in the district of the original sentencing in the Southern District of Texas. And then the government repeatedly made filings that did not include procedural default. So I think it is waiver in this case and not just forfeiture.
Let's say it's forfeiture, just to indulge me, in which case we would have discretion whether to reach it or not. Correct?
Correct.
Okay. And therefore, you've had notice and you've had opportunity, but I didn't see discussion of cause and prejudice in the reply brief.
Correct. So I've only made the argument.
Prejudice is pretty clear to me, but cause is a really tricky area of our law. Would you agree with that?
Correct.
And are you prepared here to explain why, if we were to reach it, there would still be cause?
I haven't briefed that in this case,
but are you prepared?
I've waived it. And so my argument is that the government has waived procedural default.
Okay.
And in addition to what I was saying earlier about what happened in Florida, also, and the government's repeated opportunities to raise it in the district court, there also is the law review article that I cited by Leah Littman that talks about the government waiving procedural default in Johnson litigation. They also expressly waived procedural default in their Supreme Court reply brief in the Welch case. And then I cited the Taylor case in this court as well, where the government had waived it. So I think in light of all of that, it is waived in this case.
And the cause, just imagining it, the cause argument, if you can sort of play with me a little bit, would be he asserted it promptly after Johnson came down?
He did, but file within 13 days of the Johnson decision coming down. So he certainly tried to.
But some of the circuits that have wrestled with this have said vagueness is a pretty old doctrine.
Correct.
It was still, the tool was out there.
Right. Some courts have said that that was enough, that it was some litigants were making the argument, even though I think for most people it was a big surprise when Johnson came down. And Mr. Senegal was pro se for quite a while, and including in this case for quite a while, and certainly asserted the Johnson claim very quickly and was very diligent in asserting it.
The more frontal issue is an interesting doctrine that's had its own life, which is the concurrent sentence doctrine.
Yes. So I think there's three reasons why the court shouldn't apply the concurrent sentence doctrine in this case. One is, again, the district court. The government did not raise it in the district court. And so under this court's Jackson decision, the court can't use that to affirm since it wasn't advanced below. Also, it is a discretionary doctrine that the Supreme Court has described in the Benton v. Maryland case as haphazardly applied without any satisfactory explanation. And The court also shouldn't use it to affirm in this case because the animating principle behind the doctrine is really about judicial economy. But in this case, to quote the Fourth Circuit, that ship has sailed. The government didn't assert it in the district court. And most of its out-of-circuit cases that it cites in its brief, it was brought up in the district court, not for the first time in appeal.
Would you agree that the Ray decision and the worry about special assessment, we don't have that problem here because you're not attacking the conviction?
That is correct. Yeah, so it doesn't come up in a lot of cases because there is that special assessment. So that's one reason why it doesn't come up or like legally can't be applied in those types of cases. So we don't have that here. But it remains that it's a discretionary doctrine that's fundamentally based on judicial economy. And we don't have that in this case because the government didn't raise it until appeal. And there are the cases from the Fourth Circuit in Benton and the D.C. Circuit in Smith where those courts declined to apply the concurrent sentence doctrine when the government had not raised it in the district courts. So we would ask the court to follow.
It's a variant of harmlessness, isn't it?
Yes.
And here, unless I'm wrong, the two counts that have the possible Johnson vulnerability were the ones where the court didn't max out. On every other count, the court maxes out. We've got a functional concurrent life sentence.
Right. It's actually a consecutive life sentence.
It's
but
consecutive,
yes.
but to use the terminology in some courts, it's a functional equivalent of a concurrent life.
Right. And that's where the Pepper case from the Supreme Court comes in. I did cite that case, and in that case, the Supreme Court held that it is appropriate for district courts to consider post-sentencing rehabilitation. And that's something that the concurrent sentence doctrine cases don't really address. Most of them, again, that the government has cited in this brief, predate even the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984, but they definitely predate the Supreme Court's decision in 2011 in Pepper. And so in that case, the Supreme Court recognized and talked about the sentencing package doctrine as well, that when the appeals court alters one part of the district court sentencing calculus, the remand is appropriate. And on that remand for resentencing, the district court is allowed to consider post-sentencing conduct.
So this is where you wanted to begin. So now we're here.
Yes. So okay. I do think they're related.
Just so I understand. Yeah, they are related. You're not saying that we are obligated to remand for a full redo. You're just saying that the package doctrine favors doing that. Or are you saying we don't have authority to do a limited remand just as to these two counts?
I think the court should
but
remand
for we have precedent that does both, correct?
Right. And the concurrent sentence doctrine has been described as a discretionary practice that courts engage in. I would point out that the Ninth Circuit in an en banc decision in DeBright in 1984 abandoned the concurrent sentencing doctrine entirely, finding that its disadvantages outweighed its
Let's say we don't apply the concurrent sentence doctrine. There is Fifth Circuit precedent that we would just vacate the sentences on the two infringing. So there are two outcomes that the government hasn't argued for that. I think the government says if we're going to vacate, we should just vacate and remand on those two counts, right? That's
the
government's position.
The government's primary argument is affirmed, but yes.
If not. So if we were to do what you're recommending, which is vacate in the first instance and even remand for full resentencing, could the government just dismiss those two counts and moot the resentencing? Do you understand what I'm asking?
Yes. I haven't thought about that because the government hasn't suggested that they would do that.
Because I saw a variant on the concurrent sentence doctrine was our court unique among the circuit courts. We'll just vacate the counts, the sentences. They just vacate.
Right, and they suspend imposition of them.
Right.
And then someday, if there's a collateral consequence,
right,
maybe the government can come back and have them reinstated. And that is
the government
one
isn't
reason.
Asking for that, but it seems to me roughly equivalent to the government saying, okay, fine, it's a full resentencing, but we're going to dismiss these two counts. Game over.
I think under 2255B, the court should remand for resentencing the case. That is one of the options. And I've cited the Second Circuit's case in Kazu, which talked about, especially in this situation where we have a new sentencing judge who doesn't have that privileged access to the original sentencing court's decision-making
But we know
process.
The original sentencing court had a severe life sentence in mind, and it's hard to see interconnectedness. You can push back on that.
Sure. It's related. The new sentencing judge in the Kazu case from the Second Circuit, and then also the Pepper case, where if the court were to remand for resentencing, Mr. Senegal would be able to present new information about his post-sentencing conduct. And in the Kazu case in the Second Circuit, the court talked about how 11 years had passed since the original sentencing, and it wasn't entirely sure what the district court had done when it originally imposed sentence. Maybe the crime of violence determination mattered, maybe it didn't, but the court wasn't sure. And so it remanded for resentencing in part because, you know, 11 years had passed, and here we have 20 years have passed since the original sentencing. So it's, my argument is combining those things. Yep. And I would point out that the court has remanded, this court has remanded in several cases, even though there may be not have been a great chance that the defendant would receive a lower sentence. For example, in the two McRae cases, the court originally remanded because it wasn't sure how exactly the district court had convicted its sentence package. The court remanded in the first McRae case for insufficient evidence, and then the district court imposed the same total sentence. There was another appeal, and in the second McRae case, this court again vacated the conviction and remanded for resentencing, even though the district court had perhaps indicated that it was going to impose the same sentence. And still, under the sentencing package doctrine, the court remanded because district courts have to consider a wide array of factors when they're imposing a sentence. And so it makes sense to remand and let the district court in the first instance make that determination. There's also the Jones case that I cited where even though three of the defendants had received life sentences, two of them had received two life sentences, the court still remanded for further proceedings. In the Rose case, the court remanded for further proceedings even though the defendant had a mandatory consecutive life sentence under 3559, and the court still remanded for further proceedings. And then also in
mandatory consecutive life.
Yes. Okay. And in this case,
that's like the Oslin case, the Eighth Circuit case they cite.
Right.
It was consecutive life.
Yes,
it
was.
And the court did still apply the concurrent sentence doctrine.
It did, but the court did not recognize Pepper at all in that case. And that is one of my arguments. And the Purcell case out of the Second Circuit was one where the appeals court expressly did not apply the concurrent sentence doctrine because of the Pepper decision from the Supreme Court. And I also wanted to bring up the Ecuador-Rookie case. I'm probably not saying that correctly, but this was the case involving aggravated identity theft. And the government in that case successfully persuaded this court to apply the sentencing package doctrine, even though there's a specific statutory provision in 18 U.S.C. 1028A that says that a district court can't compensate for the mandatory two-year sentence on aggravated identity theft when imposing sentence. And this court still applied the sentencing package doctrine
when
the government
requests. In your view of the law, when is the concurrent sentence doctrine still available?
I think it's mostly not still available in, you know, a lot of the cases are older cases.
This would be almost the paradigm where you don't have a special assessment and you've got concurrent, well, you've got life sentence and you've got...
Right.
Yeah.
But part of what the sentencing package doctrine recognizes, that it's difficult to say what exactly all went into the district court sentencing calculus. Mm-hmm. So when this court changes by making a decision that changes one part of that calculus, then the court should remand for resentencing to allow the district court to weigh all the factors again, also including post-sentencing rehabilitation and any other new information that's allowed to be considered at a resentencing under Pepper, to then weigh all the 3553A factors and fashion an appropriate sentence that fits both the offense and the offender. I would also point out that under the guidelines, under 5G1.2, that is another part of the modern federal sentencing landscape, and that directs district courts to basically impose a sentencing package and consider concurrent and consecutive sentences and not necessarily focus on the individual counts of conviction, but to consider all of that to arrive at the appropriate sentence. So in light of Pepper and the guidelines and the modern sentencing doctrine in federal courts, the court should apply the sentencing package doctrine.
Thank you, counsel.
And I reserve some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Sand.
May it please the court, Andrew Sand for the United States. This case has gone on for over two decades. In 2008, at sentencing, Senegal did not raise any challenges to his counts 4 or 8, nor did he discuss the residual clause, but the district court did discuss its clear intent to impose a total life sentence, including consecutive life sentences on counts 3 and 7. Since then, Senegal's case has had almost 20 years of review, including multiple times before this court. And now he stands before you with all 8 convictions undisputed and all but 2 sentences undisputed, including 2 undisputed consecutive life sentences on counts 3 and 7.
So you've got an array of obstacles and not interlocking. So what's the primary, what's the government's position as to our primary approach to this?
The government's position as to this court's primary approach would be to exercise its discretion and apply the concurrent sentence doctrine to decline review of his successive 2255. And that's for several reasons. As Your Honor alluded to, this is almost the paradigmatic case for application of the concurrent sentence doctrine. Changing his sentences on counts 4 and 8 would not affect his total life sentence because those sentences are followed by 2 undisputed consecutive life sentences, and he would not suffer any collateral.
But it is called the concurrent sentence doctrine for a reason.
Yes, Your Honor.
And here we have a consecutive.
Yes, sir.
What's your best case where a circuit court post-Ray applied the concurrent sentence doctrine facing consecutive stacked sentences?
Yes, Your Honor. We have several cases. So the primary one Your Honor already talked about is the 8th Circuit's case in Osland. So in that case, there were 2 concurrent sentences. Count 1 was for Hobbs Act robbery, 20 years. Count 3 was for an ACCA enhanced felon in possession. Those were concurrent, and they were followed by a consecutive life sentence of life for murder.
But there's several difficulties there. I think the government asserted consecutive sentence doctrine from the start.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
Number one. Number two, there, if I'm not mistaken, the court's analysis as to why it would apply to stacked sentences is just in a footnote. They just put in the word functional equivalent in a footnote. They don't explain how concurrent sentence actually applies to consecutive sentence.
I think stepping back, the principle is, it's pretty logical, right? The concurrent sentence doctrine generally holds that if there are, let's say, 3 stacked sentences, if you vacate one of those sentences and it would not affect the other sentences, which are equal or longer duration, then this court can decline review of that one challenge sentence because it would have no effect on the total sentence. The consecutive life sentence variant of this is even more extreme, I think, because in that case, the challenge sentence is followed by consecutive life sentence, 2 consecutive life sentences here.
It's a thin reed that's left. I mean, even in Osland, which I agree is the one case that I see it being applied to consecutive sentences, it drew a dissent, and the dissent cites to the 5th Circuit that doesn't go that way.
Yes, Your Honor. We'd also direct this court's attention to some of the other out-of-circuit cases. They involved consecutive life sentences. Duca out of the 3rd Circuit involved a consecutive sentence, and Ruiz out of the 7th Circuit involved a consecutive sentence. So,
well, be careful there. I mean, you know these cases better than I do, but Ruiz ends up rejecting the consecutive sentence doctrine.
Yes, Your Honor.
So when you say to me just sort of quickly, oh, Ruiz is support too, that's flatly contrary to what the court said.
Yes, Your Honor. I think Osland is our strongest case for that.
And in Osland, the dissent cites us for doing something different.
Yes, okay. Yes, Your Honor.
So it's a tricky area, and this is coming up late.
Yes, and so I think Your Honor is alluding to the fact that the government did not assert the concurrent sentence doctrine below.
I'd always thought harmlessness existed, but we've got Ray, and the Supreme Court seems to be tightening it up, and opposing counsel's got the good point with the guidelines, with so many things interlock.
Yes.
It's difficult for us to say.
Many things are interlocked in this case.
Yeah. And there isn't much judicial economy, as you began with. We're 20 years down the road here.
Agreed. I think it would serve judicial economy to apply the concurrent sentence doctrine because it would
end
this case.
Avoid one more step. Huh? Avoid one more step.
Yes, Your Honor. On the fact that the government did not raise the concurrent sentence doctrine below, we direct this court's attention to the 2nd Circuit's case in Kassir. In that case, the court applied the concurrent sentence doctrine, and in doing so, it determined that the government had waived the concurrent sentence doctrine by raising it only in a footnote, but then, quote, held, the concurrent sentence doctrine is a discretionary, judicially created tool meaning the court can invoke it when, as here, the government waived it. I think that's what the court should do. It's a discretionary tool. The court should exercise its discretion here.
I mean, you heard my questions to opposing counsel. Can't you achieve the same rather than asking us to do it? Am I misunderstanding why the government can't just dismiss these two counts? Or you could ask us affirmatively to vacate the sentence on both of them.
Yeah, I like my esteemed colleague, that thought experiment, I haven't really thought about what it
may not be
how that would work exactly. But I'm representing the case on appeal here, and so we're trying to figure out what the best outcome is for the government in this appeals case, not in conjunction with what would happen.
Let's say we don't apply it, and so we are remanding. Then we encounter the issue of the sentencing package doctrine.
Yes,
Your Honor. Is your position that that doctrine doesn't exist, or that it doesn't exist when there isn't an attack on a conviction, or that it does exist, it's just in our discretion, and we shouldn't utilize it here because we know what the original sentencing judge meant?
Our position is that it does exist. I've argued it myself in appeals, but that it's not appropriate for this case. And that's because the sentences for counts 4 and 8 are not bundled, meaning interdependent and interrelated with any other convictions and sentences. And this court has said that what that means is that if you vacate one of the challenged sentences or counts, it necessarily requires review of the entire sentence. Usually, you have to find some indication in the sentencing record of bundling, or it has to actually change the guidelines calculations. Here, if you actually look at the sentencing record, as Your Honor alluded to, the sentencing record shows the district court's clear intent to impose a life sentence on counts 3 and 7. The facts in this case were egregious, and it went to trial, and the sentencing court talked about the trial evidence of Senegal's botched bank robbery, his attempted murder of a witness, and his incredibly high criminal history. And it talked about how it was giving Senegal a harsh sentence, and specifically said that, you know, counts 3 and 7, the consecutive life sentences, were established beyond a reasonable doubt. That's during the sentencing pronouncement at ROA 3357. The other thing I would note about the sentencing package is that this same argument was raised before the Eighth Circuit in Auslan, and it was rejected. And in that case, the court held that because Auslan's conviction for felon in possession, it's almost an analogous case here, remains valid, and extensive evidence in the record indicates the sentencing judge would have imposed the same sentence without the ACCA-enhanced sentence. So let me talk a little bit about the authorities that my esteemed colleague has talked about. So almost in all of those cases involve a challenge. This is on the sentencing package. They involve challenges to convictions. McRae, Jones, Kazu, I will mispronounce this as well, Ekwurruke, they all involve challenges to convictions. If you vacate a conviction, it's much more likely to be bundled with another conviction or sentence. We don't have that here. This is two challenged sentences. As Your Honor noted, the sentencing judge's intent was clear. The sentencing judge maxed out every other single count except for the two challenged felon in possession counts. My esteemed colleague talked a lot about Rose. As she noted, the court did not remand for full resentencing in that case. It remanded for further proceedings. And the last time I checked, the district court had dismissed the successive 2255 for lack of jurisdiction. She talks a lot about this Supreme Court case, Peppers, and that case is not about the sentencing doctrine. It's sentencing package doctrine. It's about about the limits of what a district court can consider at sentencing. And in that case, the Supreme Court held that a district court may consider evidence of the defendant's rehabilitation since his prior sentence, but it didn't say that the district court's required to. And the facts of that case are completely different from this one. In that case, the defendant had actually been released from custody, and the issue was whether the defendant's rehabilitation while out of custody could be considered. Here, the defendant was never released from custody, and the sentencing court showed its clear intent that he never be released from custody.
You handle trial matters as well as appellate matters?
I did not handle trial matters.
No, not in this case, just generally.
Yes, Your Honor.
So I'm just curious, pragmatically, if when we do a limited remand for a sentencing in just one or two counts and not the others, what happens under Rule 32? Is a new PSR created? And is it just confined to the two counts?
I have not had that specific circumstance happen yet, so I cannot speak to it.
But the presence of the defendant is still required. They got to get pulled out of BOP, come in.
Yes, Your Honor.
Everyone just agrees to talk just about two. I was wondering if you knew. But
I can't speak to it because I've never happened. Have it happen to me. The last point I'll make on the sentencing package is that, you know, Senegal's request for a full resentencing, that's an attempt to impermissibly expand the scope of the COA here. Here, Senegal was only permitted to raise a Johnson challenge to his count 4 and 8 sentences. He's not permitted to challenge those sentences on any other basis. He's not permitted to challenge those convictions, and he's not permitted to challenge any other convictions or sentence. The request for a full resentencing is a thinly veiled attempt to make an end run around the limits of the COA here. Pivoting briefly back to the concurrent sentence doctrine, I did want to note my esteemed colleague talks a lot about these cases where the other circuits found the government waived the issue below. Smith and Benton, Smith out of the D.C. Circuit, Benton out of the Fourth Circuit. But those cases are distinguishable. If you actually look at those cases, in both those cases, the courts look at the merits of whether the concurrent sentence doctrine applies first. And in Benton, the court said that the concurrent sentence doctrine does not apply because the defendant would suffer collateral consequences from the First Step Act. And in Smith, it held that it would not apply because it was a challenge to a conviction. And then once the courts decided that the concurrent sentence did not apply, it then went on and said, oh, the government did not raise it below, so in any event, it's waived. That's different from here. Senegal would not suffer any collateral consequences. He does not challenge any convictions. So I think this court should exercise its discretion and apply the concurrent sentence doctrine. Just briefly, because Your Honor discussed procedural default.
I did bring it up, and if it's the government's choice not to bring it up because you agree with their statement that the government hasn't been asserting procedural obstacles, then you don't need to pursue it.
No, the government is asserting procedural default.
But if you are, do you disagree that in the past, because of Welch and retroactivity, the government wasn't asserting it? And so why, as to this defendant, would you?
I didn't handle those other...
You saw the law review article that cited that said the Department of Justice said, wow, this is a constitutional flaw. These people don't have qualifying counts. We don't want them in jail if they don't have convictions that count. We aren't going to raise delay as an obstacle. But you now are?
I think...
What's different about this
defendant? I think the procedural history of this case is what separates from it from others.
But how quickly did they file after Johnson came down?
I believe they filed pretty quickly after Johnson came down.
So how is he different than other defendants where the government says we don't want people rotting in jail if they don't have qualifying convictions to enhance their sentence? Why this man?
I think it really comes down to I'm not sure how it was handled in those other cases, but here I do think because it applies. He did procedurally default his Johnson claim.
Okay, well, this... It gets you into a realm with it that is tricky law. So he procedurally defaulted it and doesn't have cause, even though what? You cite one case, Granada.
Yes.
Okay, that's not a very solid case, is it, on this authority, on this case?
I believe it is a pretty solid case. It talks
a lot. I'm just going to read to you. Unlike the Johnson-Aka decision, Davis did not overrule any prior Supreme Court precedents holding that 924C residual clause was not unconstitutionally vague. That's from Granda. So it's a Davis case.
Yes.
And the court, which isn't our circuit, specifically says this is not like the predicament of defendants who are facing Johnson.
Yes, Your Honor. I think we would take the other principles that are talked about in that decision, that vagueness challenges have been around for a long time, that challenges...
So it's not novel, but if you've explored this beyond that one case you cite, courts point out that this particular issue, Johnson, is very unique when you get to actual futility. Have you read that case law?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
We have to look at the time period.
Yes.
And we're looking at 2007 when James is announced.
Yes.
Scalia's dissenting on vagueness. The rest of the Supreme Court is saying not available. And so, for example, the Sixth Circuit has said any defendant whose direct appeal comes in that period had actual futility. The
yes.
Supreme Court was not recognizing it.
Yes, Your Honor.
You didn't develop any of that. So what's your response to that here?
We don't have a great response to that here, Your Honor.
Well, the other arguments you made, you did say they're primary and they're alternative.
Yes, Your Honor. So I think, again, to kind of completely clarify our position, I think our primary argument is that the court should exercise its discretion and apply the concurrent sentence doctrine in the event that this court does reverse and vacate. We think at most it's appropriate to vacate on the count 4 and 8 sentences. Pending any further questions, we respectfully request this court affirm the district court's judgment.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. The principle underlying the concurrent sentence doctrine is judicial economy. In this case, that ship has sailed. As I said before, in Auslan, the government's best case, it had been raised in the district
court. Well, it hasn't. I mean, we've been prolonging this, of course, to make sure we get it right. But it would still be a huge imposition to remand. That was my question, sort of just in terms of pragmatics. Where your client is somewhere in BOP, he'd have to be pulled back out, brought into sentencing. I take it a new PSR would have to be done?
Yes, likely.
So, okay.
Right.
Do you know the answer to my question about if when we do limited remands, is it a more efficient process?
I think typically a new PSR is prepared, and then there can be litigation about the extent of changes.
And the defendant is present, and he gets to allocute. So
absolutely.
He could say, I behave well, I've been rehabilitated, I behave well in prison. He'd be able to.
Absolutely. Yeah. He would be there and be able to allocute, which is with the Kazu case out of the Second Circuit. That was one reason they remanded for resentencing, was because the new sentencing judge would not have heard the original allocution. And of course, 11 years had passed in that case, 20 years had passed in this case. So with the concurrent sentence doctrine being primarily motivated by judicial economy and yes, there would still have to be more litigation for a resentencing, but the fact that the government didn't raise it in the district court means that there has been a lot of litigation in the district court that has always already happened. So as far as that being the primary reason for the doctrine, the ship has mostly sailed. I will amend my answer. And then also with the two cases I've cited from the Second Circuit, the fact that there's a new sentencing judge weighs in favor. In the Kazu case, the Second Circuit talked about the options under 2255B for remedy once someone has made a claim under 2255, and one of those is resentencing, and the court found it persuasive that there would be a new sentencing judge in that case. Also, the government brought up the Kassir case, but after that, we have the Purcell case from the Second Circuit, which I cited in my reply brief, and in that case, the court expressly declined to apply the concurrent sentence doctrine because of the Pepper case from the Supreme Court. So that would be my best authority for why the court should not apply that discretionary doctrine that has been haphazardly applied without satisfactory explanation, as the Supreme Court said in Benton v. Maryland. And
what's your best case, circuit level, certainly Fifth, if you have one, in the package sentencing holistic doctrine, even though you're not attacking the convictions?
I really think the conviction and sentence distinction doesn't matter, because the way that the Supreme Court talked about the doctrine in Pepper was about one portion of the district court sentencing calculus being altered. And that is oftentimes a conviction, and I have cited a lot of cases where that is a conviction, but in this case, it's a sentence, and it has been in other cases where, and especially when in the context of the Armed Career Criminal Act, this is almost like an aggravated form of conviction that only applies when somebody has the three qualifying convictions. So in that sense, it's different than you know, and it's not like a sentencing guidelines issue, but there just are numerous cases that altogether, I think, especially like
what's the best proof in the record, the sentencing record, that the 922Gs were connected to the others?
I think the district court's entire explanation is just not clear, like in the Kazu case from the Second Circuit, how exactly the district court came up with its sentence. The district court talked about the guidelines being somewhat incomprehensible in this case. The court talked about how ultimately the sentence was greater than not sufficient, but not greater than necessary. The court talked about the crime spree, and it just talked about all of them together. There wasn't anything in the case where the court said that the Armed Career Criminal Act didn't matter. And the court also adopted the PSR, which of course did apply the Armed Career Criminal Act. So in total, I would say that the sentencing explanation is not clear that this did not matter and was not one piece of the puzzle when the district court was imposing sentence.
Thank you, counsel. We really appreciate both of you. The case has been around a lot of time, took a lot of time to work it up and give us good briefs. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
And that's it.
That's it.
Thank you. We're in recess.